First, though, it's Correspondence Report with Elizabeth Jackson.
Thanks, Hugh, and welcome. The hottest topic of conversation in Jakarta recently has been the city's jailed former governor, Ahok. But people aren't talking about his outrageous jailing on dubious blasphemy charges or the slow unravelling of some of his signature projects to fix the broken city. They're talking about his split from his biggest and seemingly most loyal supporter, his wife, Veronica Tan. Here's Adam Harvey.
Water seeps through a berm of trash into a sinking city. If ever there's a sight that summarises Jakarta, it's this. The ocean bubbling through a levee made of mud and trash, pouring into a low-slung town. 100 metres to the east, one of the few remnants of Jakarta's Dutch past. An elegant two-storey warehouse that's been converted into a maritime museum. It's one of the city's few genuine tourist attractions, and the lure in a plan by the former governor Ahok Basuki to bring more tourists to this part of town. To the west, one of the places that brought Ahok undone, the rubble of an urban slum, a kampung called Pasar Ikan, literally fish market, that was demolished as part of a flood mitigation program. The illegal dwellings, like most of North Jakarta, were below sea level and protected by a low barrier that was regularly breached. Ahok decided the residents needed to go, and the bulldozers went to work. Teddy Kusnendi was one of those evicted. We were so furious and mad that they kicked us out from our village of three generations without explanation. We're small people with no power. All we could do was scream and pray. The cleared land was to be protected by a new and bigger seawall and turned into a park. That was the plan anyway. The homes were demolished, and then the Chinese Christian governor was voted out of office on the back of ugly Islamist protests. Ahok's political opponents convinced many voters that the politician was anti-Islam. He was then convicted and jailed of blasphemy. Now, the residents of Pasar Ikan are back, rebuilding their homes on the ruins of their old ones. There's little sympathy here for Ahok. His jailing was simply because he neglected people, of him being exclusive, of being ignorant, of not serving the people well. Then he slipped his tongue into religion. That's when we could not tolerate his acts anymore. His mistakes in clearing our land was fine, but religion, there's no compromise on that. Teddy says he's not worried about the threat from the sea lapping at a new improved wall beside the site of their new homes. This place only floods every 5 years, when the palace floods. We're just fine. Our land is even better than the palace. All around the city, some of Ahok's signature works are being undone. Demolition of illegal developments has stopped. The city's poorest people are once again building their homes on the flood-prone banks of rivers and reservoirs. An attempt to improve Jakarta's apocalyptic traffic by banning scooters from main roads has been overturned by a court. Efforts to clear the sidewalks of street vendors and the detritus of a chaotic megacity have been abandoned. Walking on a footpath to lunch this week, I had to keep dodging scooters that were trying to get around the traffic. And across the city, Islamists, energised by their successful campaign against Ahok, are pushing their candidates in Indonesia's local government elections. And just when it seemed it couldn't get much worse for the former governor, he launched divorce proceedings from jail against his wife Veronica Tan. Jakarta's chat groups have been filled with speculation about affairs, clandestine meetings, and betrayal. All this seemed impossible 18 months ago. Ahok was being praised as the most effective governor in the city's history. He even admitted he was considering a presidential run. He was brash, sure, and perhaps a little hasty to evict the city's poor, but here was a leader who for once wasn't corrupt and was actually getting things done. Some of his achievements were almost biblical in their scale. Compared to easing the floods and traffic in Jakarta, parting the Red Sea would be simple. A couple of weeks ago, on the same day the city's attention was captured by the disaster at the Jakarta Stock Exchange, where a walkway collapse injured 70 young students on a study tour, another civic tragedy went barely noticed. I saw the smoke out the car window as I returned from the Stock Exchange building. Out in North Jakarta, the 17th century Dutch warehouse beside the ruins of Pasar Ikan was being gutted by fire. The lure for tourists, the link to the past, part of Ahok's vision for the future, gone. The levee made of trash is still there, leaking water into a sinking city. This is Adam Harvey in Jakarta for Correspondence Report.
Coming up soon on CR, the journo from PNG who's had enough of bad news.
Sometimes I go home feeling very depressed about all the negativity. And one morning I woke up and said, I'm going to do something very positive. For this week, I'm going to do very positive things. Not the politicians, not the bureaucrats, you know, not the businessmen, just the ordinary everyday heroes. And those that go about doing their work without, you know, complaining about issues that affect them, those that accept the way of life and they battle on.
That's the PNG Journo on a mission to inspire, coming up soon on Correspondence Report. A treacherous boat journey, dozens of desperate refugees lost at sea, and a story of love blooming amid the horror of ethnic cleansing. It was a tantalising, irresistible story, and one that promised to provide a heart-stirring glimpse at the plight of the first wave of Rohingya Muslims trying to flee Myanmar for Malaysia. But as Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane and ABC producer Jum dug deeper, the cracking yarn began to crack apart.
We arrived before sunset, just in time to film Amin on the Malaysian shoreline, looking out across the water to where he hoped his sweetheart was on a boat coming to him. A photogenic knight in shining armour, Amin had promised to marry a 19-year-old woman from a small village in Myanmar's Rakhine State, partly out of love and partly to get her away from the awful conditions in her home village. The girl, let's call her Najwa, was a Rohingya Muslim, one of the community that's been attacked by Myanmar's security services and Buddhist vigilantes, a savage, sweeping wave of murder, rape and arson that sent 680,000 Rohingyas fleeing to Bangladesh. Najwa lived further south than the worst-hit villages, but still, she wanted out. Around her, others had the same idea, and three fishing boats were organised, each carrying about 50 people. Amin, not his real name, told her that wherever she landed, he would come and meet her and look after her. If they got along in real life, they could marry. Najwa got on a boat, and that was the last Amin heard from her. That was 6 weeks ago, meaning she'd very likely drowned or had been taken hostage by ruthless people smugglers who would ransom her off or kill her. If all three boats left, there could be 150 people dead, a cruel coda to the symphony of destruction in Rakhine State. This was the story we heard, sitting on a concrete floor in a house surrounded by emerald green rice fields. The details dribbled in slowly. Questions went from English to Malay to Rohingya, then answers from Rohingya to Malay to English. The simplest yes-no clarification often took 2 minutes. For 2 days, the word brother was translated as sister. But slowly, we stitched the story together. This was the big yarn we'd come for. Myself, the ABC's producer Jum, and a local fixer who arranged interviews and translated. But there were some odd moments. When we asked Amin if we could speak with Najwa's family, they were suddenly unavailable. Eventually, Amin told us that soldiers had entered the village in Myanmar and everyone had turned off their phones. Plausible, but not convincing. We got back to Kuala Lumpur and tried for a second source. After some calling around, we got it. A contact had heard a similar story about a boat leaving. Jackpot, we had it. The first known boat to leave Myanmar for Malaysia since the attacks last year. We asked our contact to check again with the person they heard the story from. Minutes later, a call back, and it was bad news. Essentially, it was a story going around, but nobody had first-hand information about the boats leaving. Time to rethink the plan. We got in touch with a Rohingya man who'd helped us previously and asked him to go to the village and try to meet Najwa's family. He set off the next day, and when he eventually found the village Amin had told us about, it was the wrong one. The family was in another village nearby. There, our on-the-ground researcher found the people he was looking for. they eventually admitted a very different story. Najwa wasn't 19. She was in her late 20s, had been married already, and had two kids. She had tried to get a boat to Malaysia, but it hadn't worked out. Rather than being lost at sea for 6 weeks, she'd been home the whole time. And Amin knew this. In fact, he'd spoken to her the day before. We were gobsmacked. Amin had lied to us over 2 days. He'd stood there, looking out to sea longingly, knowing all the while that Najwa was safe at home. I could sort of understand Najwa and her family lying to Amin, wanting to secure her a better life in Malaysia. But why had Amin volunteered this story? What was in it for him? Attention? Sympathy? Propaganda for the Rohingya cause? I still can't really work it out. Jum and I returned to Bangkok. I spoke with the ABC's head of international news, explaining what had happened. It was the kind of conversation a reporter really doesn't ever want to have. It was the first time I'd returned from a trip without the story. Could we salvage something? Not really. We agreed it was best to spike the yarn. For a few days, I was angry that we'd been duped and embarrassed that we'd failed to deliver the story. A story that had taken weeks of planning, days of overseas travel, and cost several $1,000s. But as time passed, I started to see things differently. Imagine if we'd run it and been exposed as wrong. The Rohingya issue is highly charged in Myanmar, with a public ready to cast the international press as gullible fools who don't understand the history or the nuance of the story. In my experience, that's definitely not been the case. The ABC is not the only one to go through this frustrating exercise of being bullshitted to. Hannah Beach wrote up a similar story for the New York Times after interviewing a Rohingya boy in the camps in Bangladesh whose story just didn't check out. She was both praised and criticised, mostly along predictable political lines. And so a few things do need to be said. Yes, sometimes Rohingyas have lied to us, but so have many other people on many other occasions, including Myanmar officials. No doubt some will use cases like these to say, see, the Rohingyas have exaggerated the abuses, or even made them up. What has happened in Rakhine State has been described as ethnic cleansing by both the United Nations and United States. The bodies are starting to be found in mass graves. The systematic torching of Muslim villages is clear from satellite images. And the trauma of gang rape is apparent from the injuries and overwhelming testimony of women, who gain nothing in the telling and risk public shaming by talking to the media. Plus, the tactics of the Myanmar army in Rakhine State follow a pattern of murder and rape against other ethnic minorities in the past. The big picture is real, but some individual narratives are fake. By taking this story apart, I'm not trying to be boastful, but I am proud that our little team, led by Jum, got to the bottom of this ruse. Frustratingly, one of the best bits of journalism we did last year resulted in a story not running. But sometimes, that's exactly what's needed. This is Liam Cochran in Bangkok for Correspondence Report.
In PNG, people are used to negative news headlines about their country. They're used to hearing that living standards and services are getting worse. And just this week, news of a devastating earthquake. PNG is a country with serious problems, where the bulk of the population is poor and where modernity and development have left most people behind. But one local journalist has found there's also a deep well of pride and a hunger for stories about those Papua New Guineans who've overcome the difficulties of life. He's highlighting how hard work and a positive attitude can transform ordinary people into leaders and setbacks into successes. Here's our PNG correspondent, Eric Torchek.
Scott Whiteay knows about making something from nothing. He taught himself to make pizza in a cheap drum oven and sold it on the street so he could support his family while his wife studied. Then he built a career as one of Papua New Guinea's most experienced and respected journalists, and is now the bureau chief for MTV in Lae. But the relentless negativity of reporting on Papua New Guinea's violence, crumbling infrastructure, and poor governance wore him down. So Scott decided to do something positive instead.
Sometimes I go home feeling very depressed about all the negativity. And one morning I woke up and said, I'm going to do something very positive. For this week I'm going to do very positive things.
Scott Whiteay started a blog about Papua New Guineans who had overcome challenges or whose positive attitude stood out. Not the powerful people who dominate PNG's often sycophantic domestic news coverage, but the men and women of Papua New Guinea's villages, settlements and suburbs.
Local heroes, basically. Not the politicians, not the bureaucrats, you know, not the businessmen, just the ordinary everyday heroes. And those that go about doing their work without, you know, complaining about issues that affect them. Those that accept the way of life and they battle on.
Scott Wadde's blog is simply called Inspirational Papua New Guineans. It profiles teachers, doctors, community leaders, a designer who turned Papua New Guinea's ubiquitous woven carry bags, known as bilums, into dresses, a high school student who sold soft drinks to buy a calculator, and a man who left a rascal crime gang to become a founding father of the sport of basketball in PNG. The themes are consistent: perseverance and overcoming obstacles, things every Papua New Guinean can relate to. Even with Papua New Guinea's limited internet connectivity, the blog has reached tens of thousands of people.
After several posts, I realized that there was a thirst for this kind of material. People were really hungry for it. They wanted to read, and on the blog stats, I was getting, you know, an average of 20 to 50,000 hits a day. So it's quite a surprising response that I got on the blog itself.
Scott Wadde has provided something Papua New Guineans were desperately seeking: proof that their struggles mattered. In a country with enormous challenges of poverty, corruption and violence, the act of honouring people who succeeded despite their circumstances has started to encourage others to stay positive and work towards a better life.
The feedback that I'm getting is, you know, these are the kind of stories that we should be telling our kids. These are the kind of stories that should be in the schools. And it should be broadcast on mainstream media. But, you know, sometimes it's difficult to do that. But they are identifying with the characters. They feel the pain that this person is going through, or they are so happy with the success that this other person has gone through, and they look at the where he came from, where he is now, or where she came from. It's created that demand and for more of such stories.
Scott Wadde has also noticed that pride can be powerful. He says his blog has made people ask why they're suffering and demand answers from the people in charge.
If you put out the positive and you put that out in public, people will connect the dots and then start demanding better services, start demanding that those in power are held accountable for their actions.
Some of the blog's most avid readers are teachers in the rural parts of Papua New Guinea, who download the posts when they come to towns with mobile coverage and take them back for their students. Scott Wadde would like his material to be given to schools to show their students that there is dignity and potential in their lives. He's also looking to turn the blog into a book and says he's been inundated with suggestions of new people to profile. Scott Wadde's desire to do something positive has now inspired countless others to do the same. Someone should write a blog post about him. This is Eric Twarczyk from Port Moresby for Correspondence Report.
That's just about it this week, but next week on Correspondence Report, Adam Harvey on board the Carl Vinson in the South China Sea.
I'm in the Carl Vinson's aircraft hangar, one level below the flight deck. It's open to the sea. I can see the South China Sea about 10 metres below me, wandering around in between, underneath the wings of a bunch of F-18s in various states of repair. There's guys, mechanics in green uniforms, taking the planes apart, looking at the engines. It's very impressive. Periodically, they're raised up on these enormous elevators up onto the flight deck, and you can hear them take off and land all the time. The message that all this hardware is sending to China is that the South China Sea is not China's alone. But is China listening? So far, no. They've built on disputed reefs and shoals out in these waters. They've even built runways on them. That means that out here, China doesn't need aircraft carriers. It's got islands.
That's Adam Harvey and the Carl Vinson next week on CR. See you then.